Hey, my name's Debbie. I'm an alcoholic. This would be an awkward meeting to get up and use the restroom in, so I'm just sitting down here. Nobody's doing it tonight. No, when I was new, I thought, as Randy was announcing, that I couldn't sit still to save my life. I mean, I was one of those people that would sit in the back so I could be up and down, and I would think I had to go smoke or something. People caught on right away because they saw me, you know, up and down and jittery, and people just started grabbing me at the start of a meeting, and they would literally yank me down in a seat. And two people would sit on either side of me, and sometimes they would have to, like, put a hand on my knee to stop the shaking or just to keep me in my seat for the night. But thank God they did, because I would have had the wrong idea of getting up and down and treating this like some of the places I used to drink in, really, you know. So anyway, that just reminded me, I'm grateful that we learned to have respect for something here, because learning that here has let me have it in other places in my life. So thank God for that example of people. And I was really happy to come here tonight, actually. There are some places today that I walk into and just feel such a good feeling of being at home and in a warm group of people that are welcoming, and this is one of them. So I love coming here and being with all of you, and it means a lot to be here. So thank you. And our views today, we were all outside laughing at the weather this week, and from the snow on Monday and Tuesday till today, I was out in the snow hiking around in the woods on Tuesday, and I've been outside the last 2 days, but I love coming here, too, just for the views of your mountains out here. And for me, I need some simple ways to have some faith in something. And that's where I find it for myself. I have a friend of mine who's been sober a couple years longer than I have. And every now and then we start this discussion on, okay, what's your concept now of this God thing? You know, what's your concept now of your higher power? And it's always changing every time we come back to this conversation. But one thing that's been constant for me is finding it in places like this, with these views and being out in it. And if anyone thinks, when I first got here, I thought life might get dull not drinking. I really believe that might be the case. But today, if anybody, you know, has that thought or is new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can assure you beyond a shadow of a doubt, it is anything but dull being sober and living this life if I'm in the middle of AA. And I have days like today that remind me that I've been outside the last 2 days climbing and in Great Falls in Northern Virginia on these beautiful cliffs over the fall, the actual falls area of Great Falls. And yesterday we were in this beautiful, peaceful place where you hike down through a really quiet area of the woods to get to the base of the walls you're going to climb on, and the river's calm and peaceful right there and very still and like glass, you know. And it was just this full day of being outside and afternoon, and the sun came at this time of day in the late evening, and we were just laying on those rocks, and I had one of those moments of, thank God, I'm not drinking. When I was drinking, I used to go to a place right near there, and we would load our backpacks with cases of beer and climb up and jump off these cliffs into an area where you don't swim, because you hear all the time on the news about people dying in Great Falls, right? And for some reason, we thought we were invincible, you know, and would jump off these cliffs into the roaring water. And I looked at it yesterday and thought, I love my life today. No, thank you. I don't know. I wasn't thinking that. But I don't have a death wish today that I used to have. And it wasn't even a death wish before. I just didn't care anymore, honestly. And today I was telling Billy, however, we ended up in a much more precarious place. It was not a place where the river was still and quiet. We were up near the falls, and the water was roaring and white water, and I was trying to get out of there because my buddies were all climbing later to go to our home group meeting in D.C. tonight, and I had to get myself out of there, and I was not in a good spot trying to climb out of there on my own. And I kept thinking, I told Billy I'd be there. I told Billy I'd be there. So priorities changed, too. And but I get these constant reminders. There's something bigger than me out there, and so for me, days like this are just the best picture that there is something so much more powerful, because I had trouble believing that when I got here. Not that there was something more powerful than me, but I had trouble finding faith or belief in anything. So I hang on to days like this one and being with all of you, and I'm grateful to be here. And, you know, these weren't the kind of things that had any meaning at all. By the time I got sober, I had lost any sense of appreciation for being in a place like that, for being present in a moment to even feel fear that I felt today. I had lost any kind of sensitivity to normal human emotions, I think. And I started drinking really early. I got sober very young. My sobriety date's December 27th of 1992. And I started drinking when I was a little kid. And I'm sorry, some of you just heard all this last week. So Same story, unfortunately. You know, I'm not making it up, right? But I started drinking early. I grew up in a big Italian family, and my grandparents made their own wine, and we picked the grapes and helped bring them in the house, and the wine was made in these barrels that were as tall as I was at the time, and I loved it from the very beginning. And I have to tell you, I do not come from an alcoholic family. I'm the youngest of five kids. None of them are alcoholic. My parents are not alcoholic. My grandparents were not alcoholic. So we don't know where I came from, but even today they still say, how did you end up with us, you know? And I look at them and I think the same thing. My dad was one of my sister is 10 years older than me, one of them. And a couple years ago, something was wrong and my dad offered her like a little glass of brandy or something. You know, she was sick and he said, oh, just, you know, have a little glass of brandy. It'll clear up your head, which you'll hear in a minute was what he gave me too, and I was very little, but anyway, she's like 40-some years old at this point, and he gave her this glass of brandy, and my sister, I was mortified that she was my sister said, oh, Dad, I'll take 3 sips of that and get tired and sleepy, and I don't want to go to sleep yet, and I thought, what is wrong with you? Drink the brandy! Drink the brandy! Who cares if it makes you just push through that, right? Just drink through it, it'll get to the other side. So I get reminders all the time that I'm not like them, and they're not like me, and I had no outside reasons to turn to drinking as a solution. But for some reason, early on, I found something that made me feel good. And there was no reason to feel bad. You know, nothing was being done around me. I wasn't in a bad environment. Far from it. But someone gave me a drink. You know, if you were a little kid, you just got a little glass of wine at the dinner table. And I would drink mine, and I would drink other people's, cleaning up the dinner table and sneak around and sneak glasses and sneak bottles out of the wine cellar, and I fell in love with it really early. Everything about it, you know, the smell of it, the way it looked in my glass, sparkling in that crystal like that, I was just obsessive from an early age. And my dad, what I was telling you all about, you know, everyone's been sick in our area. I think, I don't know if people do this anymore, but I would be little and sick, and I remember like yesterday, my dad would put a little glass of brandy beside my bed, and he would tell me, if you start coughing, just take a little sip of this. It'll help you stop coughing. You'll be able to fall asleep. I thought, I don't know why he doesn't. Now I think, why didn't he give me cough medicine? Except that, you know, he didn't know either that family-sized bottles of cough medicine would be something I would drink, too, when I couldn't get my hands on alcohol at one point down the road. So that probably would have been a better solution. But he would give me this little glass of brandy and leave the room. And I would have an instant feeling of fear of, what if I cough and I drink that? But I'm still coughing and can't sleep, and there's nothing left in this glass. So I would slug down the glass of brandy and sneak down the stairs and either bring up the bottle or refill a glass or something. And this was at a really early age. So it was the answer. And the older I got, the more it just became a regular way to get through a day. So, you know, now I look at my nieces and nephews that are the age I was at that time, and it seems really unreasonable. But at the ages that some of them are, I was bringing little bottles of liquor in my backpack to school to drink throughout the day. And the days I wasn't doing it, I was having trouble getting to school throughout the day. So I wasn't one of those kids that was so out of control and in trouble that I couldn't show up. I had the opposite idea of, if I do what I'm supposed to do, nobody will bother me. So just hide whatever I'm doing. And I definitely had some outward, sloppy, drunken messes. But on the whole, I was one of those manipulative, sneaky, keep you out of my business kind of growing up drinking in that manner, because I didn't want people to stop me from doing what I was doing. And I thought, Dad travels all the time. If he comes home from the business trips and the grades are fine on the report card, I can do whatever I want. You know, that kind of mentality of keep you satisfied and keep you at arm's length, and I can continue to do whatever I want to do. And that became my way through life. Just this bad attitude very quickly developed of, stay out of my business, and I will stay out of yours. I don't ask you about your stuff. Don't ask me about mine, and leave me alone. And by the time I was in high school, I had a horrible outlook on life and people. I didn't want to be part of your life. I didn't want you to be part of mine. I didn't want you to interfere. And I really approached the world like, you against me, we're on different teams, and let's just keep it that way and stay out of my business. So not a great way to feel like you're part of the world that you're living in and have any kind of relations with people around you. And trouble started for me early with physically being so ill I couldn't drink after a certain point. I was making myself so sick, with getting into trouble at that point. I was starting to get caught for things. I was starting to find out there were things I had to hide from other people about what I was doing because it wasn't what they were doing, like the bottles of Robitussin I was drinking or the bottles of lemon extract and vanilla extract. You know, I thought I was being helpful to my best friend at a party, telling her the liquor ran out, drink this lemon extract, you know, and she just looked at me and it was one of those there's something wrong with you moments, and I thought, don't tell her, what else I do then? If she thinks there's something wrong with it, just don't tell her. And that was just one of the minor things that kind of started to clue me off to what I'm doing is a little bit different than what they're doing. But I'm not going to stop what I'm doing. So the secret started, and it was very early on. I discovered if I did what people wanted, they would give me what I wanted, and it felt like this double life started from that decision forward. And I was maybe 13 years old when I started living that way and taking those kind of actions. And I'll tell you, I don't know how any person who is alive and well can live that kind of a conflicting life, you know, and be okay. But something by an early age had shut down so much to the point where it didn't occur to me that what I was doing was dishonest or that it affected other people in my life or that that boyfriend I had for all those years might have had a problem. You know, it was entirely different worlds to me, and I felt like it's what I need to do to get some of what I want and leave me alone. It's none of your business, really. And there was no conscience about it. There was no feeling of remorse or, you know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. There was just none of that feeling that would usually accompany that kind of behavior from a young girl. But it led further to that my life is none of your business and stay out of it kind of demeanor that I walked around with. So there were a lot of moments of fun along the way, maybe, if you could call it fun. We were laughing hard at Randy's house last week when I stayed there because just all the stories that come along, I can't remember what brought it up, but I said, oh yeah, I had a run-in with a raccoon once in the middle of the night, and there were these funny episodes like that at the time that were funny, drunk and trying to get home at 3 a.m, and the raccoon in the creek, and we ran into each other, and Randy or Merv said something like, you know, wasn't that raccoon mean? I said, yeah, but I was too at the time, so I think you bounced it out, just, you know, we were both screaming and making crazy noises, and I don't know if I scared it worse or it scared me, but my friends were behind me a couple hundred yards, and they got to me, and they're like, what just went on here? You know, I was getting myself into these strange little instances, and being carried home, that same girlfriend of mine was often carting me home on her back because I was so sloppy drunk I couldn't function to keep my feet under me. You know how we get. And she would leave me under the back porch of the house to get myself inside before Dad woke up at 5 a.m. to go to work, you know. And she would take me home, and I would many times be a mess of having rolled around and the dirt and the creek and my own throw-up and liquor and whatever I'd been drinking that night, and I was usually a pretty good mess. And if it was bad enough, she would pull out the hose from under the deck and hose me off and leave me there to get back in the house. And there was one time in the middle of winter when I'm getting hosed down like this, and it was cold, and I thought, the neighbors are not doing this. I mean, I looked to my left and I looked to my right, and it was dark in those houses and there was no commotion under the deck. And that was one of those little moments of other people aren't doing all this stuff and getting into this kind of mess and this kind of trouble. And I was running around with people that were stealing cars and breaking into houses and for the fun of it, you know, no reason for the fun. We weren't doing anything. We weren't going to sell the car. We weren't doing anything at all. It was just that thrill and that rush. And it's funny, last year maybe, someone in my home group said something to me about, yeah, you adrenaline junkies always have. And I thought, what? I was so offended. Adrenaline junkie? What are you talking about, you know? But there may be a little bit of truth to that, so carried over from drinking into sobriety for me. But, there were just a lot of these instances, and some of them really weren't funny that were happening anymore. So I have a good friend who was sober, and we were in a restaurant in D.C. We were probably both about 10 years sober at the time, talking about our family, just kind of catching up, and one of my nieces at the time was getting into some of the same troubles I had been, and drinking and stealing her dad's car at night and crashing it in a drunken incident. And my friend Grace Ann, in her very loud southern accent, you know, says, "Well, you used to steal people's cars too, Debbie." And these people were beside us in this little crowded restaurant in Georgetown. I swear they were on a first date. It was that really awkward, you know, they weren't really talking. They were trying to eat very politely and a little conversation going on. And she says this and forks clatter over there. And I'm thinking, oh, how do you repair this quickly? And the first words out of my mouth were, "Yeah, but Grace Ann, we didn't steal our family's cars. We only stole cars of people we didn't know. But this is going to repair it somehow." So they left quickly. They paid a bill and they left and they were gone. So I don't, since I have gotten sober, I've never doubted that I'm in the right place and that I'm not like the average person out there. And if I ever do, we just need these little moments, right, of the regular person hearing what our life is or was like, or even today, you know, if they hear my thoughts today, they don't necessarily think the way I do. So I get constant reminders of these things. And I had just lost all sense of conscience and thought about another human being. So that's why things like paying attention and not getting up and interrupting the meeting have grown so important. I mean, today, I can assure you, today, they saw I was late getting out of these rocks I was trying to climb out of. I was dirty and grubby and a mess and cut up and scraped up and thinking, I don't feel very girly to go put on a skirt for tonight. But that's what we've learned how to do here. And I had no respect for any other human beings during the end of my drink. Well, before I stopped drinking and to the end of my drinking. And a good friend of mine, people started dying around me. A good friend of mine died drunk one night driving. And our answer to that, I don't know, we broke into somebody's house. We were drinking in somebody else's house that night. I don't know. Again, that thrill of maybe we'll get caught, maybe something will happen, that rush of excitement to distract me from myself that I was always going for. And then the day came I broke into a family member's house, which is not something you really think you're going to end up doing at any point in your life. But I, you know, broke into my sister's house and had a mass of people in there because she and her husband had been sent to babysit me at my house while my parents went out of town because I'd been getting in so much trouble. And they were supposed to make sure everything was okay that weekend. And my solution was, well, then we're going to go to your house. And we did. And I waited till they went to bed and snuck out, and we broke into that house. And you can imagine what kind of damage was done in there with all kinds of people in and out for the night and fire in the fireplace. And, I mean, it was, you know, crazy. And I was such my usual drunken, sloppy mess leaving there before sunrise that my friend said, "Don't you think we better clean up a little more?" And I said, "Oh, they'll never know that anybody was in here. Don't worry about it." And, you know, we had garbage bags of cans and bottles that we were just dumping outside the house on the street for the trash to pick up the next day, thinking they'll never know. And I think we left the fire still roaring in the fireplace, and the house was trashed from all the people in it, and we had broken in. You know, it wasn't like I just walked in there. We had broken into the house, so there was all kinds of stuff in disarray. And my sister called me the next day when she had gotten home in complete hysteria, telling me that police were in her house fingerprinting. The house had been broken into. She said, "We're coming over right now to talk to you because we just want to know if you might have had anything to do with this." And she got back to my house that afternoon, and her husband sat across the table from me and said, "Can you please just tell us if you know anything about this? Because at least I won't be afraid to sleep in my bed every night thinking somebody's breaking in, and what are they coming here for, and why did they break into my house? As horrible as it would be, at least I'll know it was you, you know." I don't know why she suspected me, for crying out loud, right? They were on to me. And all I could think of that day was, I can't get in trouble for this. I can't be sent somewhere. I can't be told to stop drinking the way I'm drinking. And I looked her dead in the eye with no human emotion whatsoever and said, "I have no idea what you're talking about. We were sleeping in the same house last night. You're crazy." And that took years into sobriety to repair that kind of damage done. So thankfully we have these steps and the amends to go through, and all kinds of steps to get to the point of the amends, and it works. It does work. And she and I are very close today, and I'm the godmother of their youngest son, and they let me take their three boys, and they trust me with them, and repairs happen here for the kind of inhuman behavior that I was exhibiting during that period of time. So that just gives you a little clue, though, of my level of conscience and care for the people around me at that time. And I was talking about this last week, too, but for years into sobriety, I referred to her as my crazy sister. You know, she's not alcoholic, whatever. She's got her own stuff. But here I am calling her crazy, you know. And I would talk to my sponsor, and I would tell her, I don't know what else to do to make amends with her. She's crazy, this and that, and, you know, she sees the whole world messed up. Like, I'm one to be talking about seeing the world from a warped perception, but I had all these reasons why I thought she was crazy and there was no way to have a relationship with her. And finally, one day, my sponsor said, you need to start by not calling her your crazy sister anymore. You refer to me by her first name only from here on out, and you never use that term with her again. And I thought, what does that have to do with making amends? She is crazy. You know, what does that have to do with any of this? And what I came to find out several years into sobriety was it has to do with the change of heart that's needed in me to go ahead with the eighth and ninth step and to have this inner change to make some kind of change with how I relate to you and to everyone around me. So thankfully I've had people patient and take me by the hand to walk me through this stuff, because I would have never put that together, you know, ever. And that day I stopped calling her the crazy sister. And imagine, we became friends, actually, and we get along fairly well today. And the one I called crazy has so much more grace and integrity than I do. A couple of years ago, I was sitting at her house for dinner with her and her husband and her three kids. And someone's house down the street had been broken in. And her three boys are afraid. It was their friend's house. And the littlest one, my godson, is asking, you know, Mommy, what if someone breaks into our house? Has someone ever broken into our house before? What if? And I'm sweating. Like 12 years sober, in a panic, thinking, oh, this poor little kid's entire picture of me is about to crash to the ground. I mean, talk about being sober for a while and still having feelings of remorse, for even though amends have been, you know, but the truth is, I don't want to forget those things either, because I don't want to go back to living that way. So those little reminders for me are all I need to keep doing this every day when I don't want to show up for a meeting, when I don't want to call my sponsor, when I don't want to call someone else for help if I can't reach my sponsor. That is my reminder. You better do it, because there's going to be a little kid like that that's going to be really disappointed one day. And I'm going to hate that feeling of living in my skin like I used to. So anyway, he's asking this, you know. And I'm sweating at the table and in your panic again. And my sister, without flinching, just looked at him and said, Christopher, don't be silly. You're perfectly safe. No one has ever broken into our house, and you're fine. And I just thought, oh, so the crazy one is not the crazy one after all. And I'm learning something to this day from people like her in my life. So it's just a gift to be able to wake up and see things with clarity like that and not keep pointing the finger at everyone else, blaming them for the way I feel and the way I am and the way I have to drink at you, because that was my way. I would drink at people. I would drink at circumstances I didn't like, drinking at the world for whatever. It didn't matter. You know, it could be a good or a bad thing, but if I didn't like it, I was going to go drink, and who pays the price, right? The joke's on me with that one, but that was my attitude. So I was 17 when I first got to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I had heard someone tell their story in a non-AA setting, but he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't say that, but what he was describing were things that were going on right at that moment for me. He was talking about his skin being a kind of funny color. He was talking about not being able to hold food down or hold drinks down anymore. He was talking about that pit of alcoholic loneliness, that anxious apartness that I was in the midst of feeling, because I couldn't look you in the eye anymore. I couldn't have a conversation with you anymore. I couldn't, like I said, show up if I didn't have a couple bottles in my backpack anymore or in my purse. I felt like a sorry excuse of a human being most of my waking hours, really. So I hear this guy describing this, and in a moment of poor judgment, I later thought, you know, I went and said to him, so how did you stop doing that? You know, and just what he was waiting for. This guy's eyes lit up. He got all excited. He's a talker. He talks like crazy. Before I knew it, I was sucked into this conversation that lasted for 2 hours about Alcoholics Anonymous and this and that and all these fun things we do. And I'm like, God, I didn't really want all this, you know? And he brought me to a meeting And I had no interest. I didn't doubt that I was an alcoholic. I knew by this point there was something horribly wrong with my reaction to life. I didn't drink. My life wasn't the way it was because I drank. I drank because of the way I was on the inside, and drinking was the best way to try and escape that. So, for whatever reason, though, I just didn't want to do this. I didn't want to find out what this was. I wasn't ready to stop drinking. I wanted to keep on this run I was on, and I didn't care if it was bad, and I didn't care if I had no people left in my life, because at that time, like I said, I was moving into a college dorm with people that didn't want to talk to me anymore, and leaving a family that didn't know what to do with me anymore. But I didn't want to do whatever this was. I didn't even know what this was. But I sat in this AA meeting, and the room was full of smoke. It was still a smoking meeting, and it was so crowded that we were sitting on the floor on the carpet in the front under the layer of smoke that was hanging in the top of the room. And I saw an old friend who I'd gone to school with from maybe like kindergarten through the middle of high school. I'd gone to school with this guy, and I don't know why we were talking about this too. I don't know why seeing somebody that I had grown up with in an AA meeting. I mean, now I would almost find comfort in that, but at the time it just sent me into one of my absolute panic attacks that I was having frequently then. And I ran out of the meeting, and this guy that brought me there chased me out of the parking lot, and I'm, in the parking lot beating on him. Why did you bring me here? I'm just a big drama, of course. I'm not, I don't want to do this. I don't belong here. And he just took a step back, and he smiled, and he said, well, you have my phone number one day if you change your mind. And he didn't pressure me. He didn't try and talk me into needing the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came in and out for a while. For 2 years, I was around Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, this girl is going to be your sponsor. I said, I don't want one of those, whatever that is. No, thank you. She would call me and tell me she was going to come get me for a meeting, and I would slam the phone down on her. I was belligerent and unwilling, and I would just show up when I had a bad day. I might show up at a meeting, and then I would be highly offended when people would say, we haven't seen you. Have you been drinking? And I would, that bad, again, what are you talking? Of course I've been drinking, but how dare you ask me that? Of course I've been drinking. And I spent a couple of years that way. I stopped drinking. I was dry for maybe 9 or 10 months during that period, just out of total terror of an instance that happened one weekend, a bad weekend of taking too many things and drinking too much altogether and thinking I was not going to wake up on Monday morning. I thought, this is it, and I'm relieved. I felt like, I hope I don't wake up. I'm tired. I think I was almost 18 at the time. I was just tired and could have cared less. I didn't go ask anyone for help when I thought physically something horrible was happening. I just thought, oh well, here you go, this is what you get. And I laid there that weekend in that condition, and it scared me enough to think I'm going to try this not drinking thing for a while. But I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. So with no solution and no drinking, the madness went wild in my head. I spent the next 9 months maybe of not drinking, and it might have been longer. But I became miserable. My college roommate actually moved out of my dorm. I was so unbearable not drinking. I would think, see, I'm sober. It's not getting better. Clearly it's getting worse. But I wasn't sober. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was about, what the steps, the sponsor. I wasn't doing any of that. So the idea of thinking that sobriety didn't work was a load, because I had never had any idea even what was being offered here. So I just wasn't drinking. And I got violent. I started punching cinder block walls. I was in school for painting. I broke a bunch of bones in my hand because I punched the cinder block wall in my dorm room. I couldn't paint for months. Could have cared less. And all these little things that I had dreamed about at one time or another, like the painting, were just kind of falling by the wayside. It didn't matter anymore. It just didn't matter. I had no hope or desire for any of it. And I had nobody to talk to during this period of time. And that attitude of me against the world, stark raving sober, got more lovely. And I wasn't making friends or having anything to do with people that had been in my life. And people had been offering for a long time to help in some way. My parents were frequently asking, is there anything? Can you just tell us what is wrong with you? We will do anything we can to help you if you can tell us what's wrong and what you need. And I couldn't tell them. I had no idea what to say to them. I was thinking, well, Mom, your voice sounds like fingernails on a chalkboard right now. I'm in a near panic attack. I can't breathe. I haven't had something to drink for 2 days, and I just need a drink to calm down, and then I can sit here and listen to you rattle off whatever you have to rattle off. That was my thinking at the time. But I couldn't have said what was wrong or what I needed or what kind of help there might be. And I was getting carted off. You know, they took me to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist even said, I don't know what to do with her. Maybe take her to AA. I don't think I can help her. Okay, so we don't go back to that psychiatrist again. The day came when, still back in high school, when I first tried to get sober, and I was called out of a class and brought into this office, and there sat my parents in this office in my high school, and they said, we're going somewhere today, and they put me in a car, and another one of those times I hope I don't forget, they put me in the back of the car, and it was pouring rain out that day, one of those horribly dismal, ominous sky, dreary days where the rain just seemed like it was going to come forever, and I remember it clearly, because I spent the next 2 hours with my forehead beating against the glass window, staring at this rain pelting the window, with my dad in the front seat and just that look of discouragement and disappointment for his youngest kid, and my mom, her hysterical crying mess about where did we go wrong, and, you know, and I felt this guilt like I could never describe because they didn't do anything wrong, and I knew that, and I couldn't even pretend that they had. But I didn't know how to, what do you say? I mean, what do you say to your mom in the front seat, hysterical about how did she cause this mess in the back, and she hadn't done anything in the world but be a wonderful mom to me, like she had to the rest of her kids, and so here we are in this car, you know, and I'm literally just beating my head on the window, like, God, when is this going to end? I can't take this, and we drove out of Northern Virginia into some rolling green hills, and I'm, oh, this is kind of pretty, I wonder where we're going, you know, and a little white picket fence came up, and then a big sign for Springwood Metal Institute came up, and we hung a left in there. And they brought me in there for some assessments, and luckily, my parents are just people who don't necessarily believe that a bunch of medication and doctors are the answer. So I don't know how I fell into that luck, but I'm glad I did, and I'm glad that they have those beliefs, and they didn't want their daughter loaded up on all kinds of stuff and locked up for long periods of time. I might have needed to be. Who knows, that locked up part anyway. I might have needed to be, but they didn't want that. And thank God they didn't, because I eventually got to Alcoholics Anonymous, which is where I believe I needed to be. So I was never in a treatment program or anything like that. I didn't come here through doctors or treatments or rehabs. Not that there's anything wrong with people's experience that have had that, but mine was just Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was finally ready a couple of years later, I knew where that phone number was to call. So I spent this period of time a little bit later not drinking, like I said, and my alcoholism goes wild when I stop drinking. That is when the ism starts and the madness in the head and the craziness is, I mean, people that are problem drinkers, I've seen them. I mean, I drank with some of them through that time. I had friends that were doing a lot of what I was doing, you know, but they would get in trouble and stop drinking, or they would fail out of college and stop drinking, or some, you know, something would happen. That friend of ours that died, some of them stopped drinking, other people around me were dying from things I had much more involved contact with, and it was reason to keep drinking, you know. So other people stop drinking, and they kind of seem to shape up, and, you know, they're married, they have kids, they're living normal lives, and I stop drinking, and everything breaks loose in a horrible way. So after a while of this, I made a conscious decision of, I don't want this. I'm going to drink. Of course I'm going to drink. This is so painful and so uncomfortable and so miserable, and I couldn't talk to people. I couldn't carry on conversations. I couldn't show up for classes anymore, sober. I mean, sober, I couldn't show up to classes. And it was just an easy decision. If this is what it's like not drinking, I'm going to drink. And I did, and I had this all very carefully planned out. I was being meticulous about it. I'm going to go here on this night, and I'm going to have 2 cans of beer. I really thought through this carefully for myself, and I hated beer. I never drank beer. I don't know why that was what I picked. I loved wine. I liked sweet drinks. I liked brandy and peach schnapps, and vodka and rum snuck their way in. That was my ending drinking, but I chose 2 cans of beer this night, and I remember drinking 2 cans of beer at a party, and I wasn't going to parties by then. I didn't like people. I didn't want to be around you. I didn't know how to talk to you, so none of it made sense as to why I chose a party and beer and all this, but I did, and And that's really all I remember until coming to the next day, and I was somehow back in a dorm room, an empty one, because my roommate had moved out, I told you. So I was in this room by myself, waking up and wondering why it felt really hard to move and hard to get out of bed. And I made my way into the bathroom and was just a bloody pulp of a mess. I looked like I had been beaten to a pulp the night before, and the whole left side of my body was just cut, blood, bruise, gravel stuck in me, those clothes shredded down the left side of my body, black and blue. I was a bloody mess, literally. And I looked in the mirror that day, and I made my second conscious decision in that week of, if this is the price I have to pay sometimes, I'm just going to have to pay it, because I'm not going to try to not drink again and feel the way I just felt for the last however long, 9 months or a year, of not drinking. That was a very definite decision I made, and I cleaned myself up, and I heard bits and pieces of the story later of getting sloppy drunk like I always did, and being dragged. Police were coming. They were trying to break up this party, apparently, and we were at a big old house on a huge hill on top of a gravel driveway, and I was refusing to leave. So my first night back, the belligerent attitude was already alive and well and kicking as if I had never stopped drinking and refusing to leave, knowing the police are on their way, and people had tried carrying me and dragging me down this half a mile long gravel driveway, and I was fighting them and throwing up and punching them, and they would drop me and drag me a little further, and I don't know what else happened, but that was part of the story, at least, of how I ended up in this physical condition. I thought, oh, well, you know, this is just how it's going to be sometimes. Let's hope every night is not like this. And I drank for a good period of time after that, and there was nothing significant that happened. I can't tell you why I picked up the phone and finally called someone in AA after that. I spent the next while drinking, and it was much like that experience. It was not a pretty, fun, oh, let's have fun drinking like I used to kind of time. It was by myself a lot and miserable and alone and desperate, really drinking out of desperation much of the time. And I finally just one day, again, got tired. I was so tired, and I felt like I don't want this. I just don't want this, meaning my life, myself, whatever. And I had a phone number left of someone at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called, and she was smart. She didn't drag me to a meeting. She said, do you just want to get together for coffee and talk for a while? Think, people in AA, I just have never have I met such warm people, unique, talented, gifted people in so many ways. And this woman was one of them, and she just knew how to talk to me that day. And she sat me down and said, why don't you just tell me what's been going on since we saw you last? And she never pointed a finger or said, you know, we told you, or see what happens when you drink. She never did any of that or tried to make any points to me or teach me a lesson or anything. She just listened to me talk for all that time, and she finally said, well, we're around the corner from the meeting. So she was smart about where she brought me from. She said, we're around the corner from the meeting, and it's almost 8:30. Do you think you want to go now? And after telling her, after painting this very vivid picture out loud to another human being of what I had just been living like, how could I? I said, I will go with you to that meeting. And spend the next couple months in meetings. Lying, I drank after that several times. I had this drunken weekend somewhere in Columbus, Ohio that I didn't remember until many years sober with people I sponsor, thinking I knew. We were at a conference. We went to see my sponsors up there at a conference, and I thought I knew where things were. I've been here before. I had no idea where anything was. I was in a blackout most of that last weekend in Columbus, Ohio, so nothing was where I thought. I was so sure that it was, and I had forgotten about that, so we're driving around these streets trying to find this place, and anyway, I didn't tell anyone about weekends like that. I just kept coming to meetings, and my sponsor was forcing me at the time, you know, raise your hand and say you have this many days sober, and I'm thinking, oh, I don't really want to do that anymore, but of course I drank again, living in, again, another lie like that. And on Christmas night, someone took me to a meeting, and I sat in a room with all of you, and she drove me home and said, are you going to drink tonight? I just have this funny feeling about you, and I was so offended once again, and told her she was crazy, and of course I wasn't going to drink. And I walked in the house and opened the cabinet and got a bottle of rum and spent this night in a basement drinking by myself again, waking up the next morning physically drunk, but the head was roaring as usual. And someone called me that morning and heard what was going on, and he said, can you not drink until I get to your house to pick you up for the meeting tonight? And I said, of course I cannot drink until you get here. You think I'm going to be drunk by the time you come? You know, you think I want to see you like that? And I sat in the front living room of the house with a bottle of wine, drinking it. I didn't do anything that whole day. I sat in that chair looking out the window because I knew if I went anywhere, I wouldn't be there when he got there that night. So I made myself sit in that chair where I could see the driveway, and I drank that wine until he showed up in my driveway. The headlights pulled up that night to pick me up for the meeting, and that's my sobriety date, thank God. But I still had a lot of fight and very little surrender in me at that time, and I came in here still not sure if I wanted to do. I don't know why I thought there was something so tough and demanding and difficult. I didn't even know what you were asking of me, but I had this preconceived idea of, I don't want to do all that. Whatever that is, I just don't want it. You know, I don't want to answer to anybody. I had no idea that a sponsor was there to share their experience with me and tell me how she had stayed sober, not to demand. I had no idea what it was about, but thank goodness I got sober in a lively, active group of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I noticed, the one thing that I really had noticed before coming to meetings, and I remembered as soon as I walked back in there, is that they had this light in their eyes that was, it almost made me start crying. I felt that desperate for wanting to feel some kind of life again. That I would look at these people in a room and think, how do I get, whatever that is, how do I get that? Because they're talking to each other, and they're laughing, and it's genuine laughter, and I haven't done that in, I don't even remember how long. And they seem to want to be around other human beings, and I feel like my skin's coming off when I'm around other human beings. There was something about these people that was so appealing to me, that it gave me enough hope to just stick around, for whatever reason, to stick around. And like I said, I mean, they were paid, they would sit there in a meeting and pin me between them and keep their hands on me so I couldn't get up and go anywhere. And this one woman, Jennifer, would drive me home at night, and she would literally sit in the driveway with me until 3 in the morning when I was finally falling asleep in her car to put me back in the house to go to sleep that night so I didn't go drink somewhere. They'd seen me. I'd come into meetings drunk before. They knew. So people were watching out for me, and they were generous and kind and loving. And spoke this language of the heart. When I finally found my sobriety date that night, I picked up my chip. Someone said, we are offering you a friendship, and we will share our experience with you, and you don't ever have to live that way again. And I'd never heard, the psychiatrist hadn't talked to me that way. The people at Springwood Mental Institute doing the evaluation hadn't talked to me that way. You know, this was a new language, and it was something I could hear. It was something that hit the pit of my gut, where I felt so dead on the inside, and it gave me that spark of hope to hang on to. So I just started following people, and I got thrown into service, and they gave me jobs right away. Our home group is a big meeting, a couple hundred people. At the time, it was in a huge room with balconies, and it all needed to be mopped at the end of the meeting, cleaned up behind these couple hundred people. And I was 2 weeks sober, pulled into something called a group conscience. I thought, what is this all? I mean, I don't even have my own conscience. Why do I want a group? You know, so maybe I'll learn something in here. And I did. But they pulled me into the kitchen for this group conscience. And they said, oh, we have some service jobs to elect tonight. And we need an assistant cleanup person to mop the floors. And my first sponsor said, oh, I nominate Debbie, you know. And she kind of muttered to everyone, she's got 2 weeks. And everyone's hands went up in the room. And but I thought, do I have a say in this? But I didn't have a say in this. So I'm the new mopping person. And I didn't want to mop the floor, you know. I thought, this isn't fair. I want to be outside talking to people. Well, I didn't like talking to people anyway, so there was no win with me, and I didn't like any of it, and I just had a reason to fight everything. But after a year of grumbling about this service job that they had given me, when they gave it to somebody else, I would stand at the top stairs of the balcony on the way out and watch, you know, and in my head, they're mopping the wrong direction because the coffee maker is going to come walk across and they're going to mess it up and you have to turn. You know, I now had something invested in this meeting and I had a care for something other than myself, right? And that was new. I mean, that's how it started. This little bit of having life again and having a care for other human beings again started as a result of them knowing better than I did that giving me a job would let me feel like I had something to contribute somewhere because I had nothing else to contribute. I had nothing. I couldn't talk, carrying a conversation for quite some time in the sobriety. So this gave me something to feel a little bit of usefulness about. And I had no idea that that might be missing. There's a line in the foreword in our 12 and 12 that talks about becoming happily and usefully whole. There are steps, spiritual in nature, when practiced, enabling us to be happily and usefully whole. I had no idea that I was missing that. I couldn't have even put words to describe what that sense might be. But that's what people here started to give me, that sense of being happily and usefully whole again by allowing me to do things at meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous and allowing me to go pick up someone new who needed to get to the meeting that night. Those were the kind of things that got me out of my mess of a head so I didn't have to go drink again, you know. And we started going through the steps. I've always had a sponsor who is very active in Alcoholics Anonymous and believes in our book and in the steps and the program of recovery and passing it on to somebody else. And so I was taken through the steps from the very beginning. And I had all kinds of, I said I wasn't willing to surrender much, and my thinking was one of those things, and I wanted to figure it all out. You know, I thought it all had to be very intellectual, and how do I, the second step, but what does that really mean? What do I do? What is that, you know, I needed something tangible, and it wasn't fitting the puzzle. I couldn't fit the puzzle pieces together for myself, and I was finally in a meeting, probably 6 or 7 months sober, having an incredible physical compulsion to drink. I don't know what happened that day, but I was sure I was going to have to drink that night. I had never, since I'd been honestly sober this time, I had not had a compulsion to drink like this. And it was back to the panic attack, and I couldn't breathe. I couldn't talk. I was trying to tell people what was wrong. I mean, it was just a full-blown crazy spell that I was in the middle of. And as always, people sat me down in a meeting, and they said, just sit here, and we'll talk about it after the meeting. And something happened during that meeting. I can't tell you what was said. Nobody shared something that suddenly felt like, oh, the lights went on, and thank God I heard that solution tonight at all. But the meeting ended, and the shaking had stopped, and I could breathe easier again. And I didn't feel like I was jumping out of my skin. And most of all, I did not feel like I had to go home and drink that night. And my sponsor walked over to me and said, maybe that's your second step. Maybe it is as simple as that for you. And that's the truth. It had to be that simple. There was clearly something going on in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, so much more powerful than I was. You know, I didn't have to give it a label of this type of God or that or whatever image I thought I had to come up with. It didn't need any of that. It just became as simple as there is something going on here that is so much stronger than I am that is allowing me to not have to go home and drink tonight. And I've held on to that conviction and that belief and that experience from then until now, and it's changed form, and it comes and goes, and you know, we went on with the steps, and the third step, I didn't want to write the fourth step. Someone said maybe just taking the action is a little bit of a surrender for you to try it someone else's way other than your own small-minded, sad little tunnel vision of what you think you want right now to be happy, you know, and maybe if you get an idea of what this third step is, you won't be punching the poor stranger on the metro at a year and a half sober like I was doing, and I was a wreck for a while into sobriety. So I wrote the fourth step, you know, and I told someone all this stuff in the fifth step. And there was nothing extreme in it. There was nothing outrageous in my fifth step, honestly. There's nothing I wouldn't tell you today for the most part that was in my fifth step. But I had stopped revealing anything about myself to other people long ago, like most of us do, really. You know, the stuff that sits deep in my gut that I lay awake at night in turmoil over, the kind of stuff that is the last thing you want to share with other human beings, and just revealing that to another person. I didn't have one of these great moments after doing my fifth step. I just simply felt like maybe I'm like the rest of you. Maybe there's somebody else who has felt this before, someone who doesn't walk away or cringe or say, what in the world is wrong with you when they hear this? I just felt like, all right, I just told someone all of those things that for whatever reason have been eating me alive, and it's just okay. You know, nothing bad happened. And again, it was as uneventful as that. And 6 and 7 were steps that came and went and still do for years. I really believe when it talks about in the big book and the fourth step, we have to get down to the causes and conditions. Like I said, and was not the way I was because I drank. I drank because of these causes and conditions in me that were not normal reactions to life, to the world around me. And if none of those causes and conditions in me change, I believe I will drink again over the same things. And I will do anything to not go back to that. So I was willing, you know, and those kind of things started coming in 6 and 7 for me. And they still come back today. Just when I think something is set aside, you know, it pops up again here and there in a different form. And thank God, I hope I always have stuff to keep working towards or keep working on or keep looking at, because I don't ever want to get well and think maybe I don't need this anymore. You know, I have never, out of all the mistakes I've made in sobriety, I have never stopped coming to meetings. I go to a lot of meetings. I always have. I've always been in the middle of service work and trying to pass on what's been given to me to other people. And that has started to chip away at the self-centeredness and at some of those causes and conditions that I drank at and over and about. So when I was 2.5 years sober, I was getting ready to go live in Italy to paint. So things come full circle. I told you that, you know, about breaking the bones and not being able to paint and all that in school. And at 2.5 years sober, I get this opportunity. I was accepted to a school and had this opportunity. I call my sponsor in fear, my usual reaction. Good things happen, fear. Bad things, fear, whatever. And I called my sponsor and said, I got a letter. I got in. What do I do? What do I do? You know, back to that old. And my sponsor said, you go. What do you mean? You go. That's what you do. So I'm getting ready to go and live in this tiny little town where it was such a small town, people didn't speak English there, and meetings were a couple hours away, and my sponsor and I are going over an 8th step, and that was when my sponsor said, you need to have a change of heart. You need to sit on this stuff for a while and have a change of heart. And I had no idea what that meant at the time, and over writing letters to my dad and finding out that these people around me are human beings with their own thoughts and feelings going on that I had been so oblivious to my whole life, that change of heart started to come about to repair those relations with other people in my life. And I think last time I spoke here, a couple of years ago, I was telling you all, some of you, about getting ready. One of these big amends processes for me has been with my brother and his wife, and I was getting ready to go. She had breast cancer. We were climbing this mountain, raising money for breast cancer research, and we went. Since then, I've climbed a couple mountains with this group that supports this breast cancer study at Johns Hopkins. And that year, we were going to Ecuador right after I spoke here. And this past summer, we just went to Kilimanjaro, and she passed away last year, at this time last year. So I'm still a part of this thing, and it's still this process for me with my brother and his kids where I've committed to something, and people here have taught me you show up no matter what when you make a commitment for something. So I'm committed to this. So I'm going, right? My mom says, you're crazy when you stop climbing these mountains. And on the inside, I think, no, there's a reason behind this. It's more than that adrenaline junkie thing that someone accused me so unfairly of, right? So I'll climb to 20,000 feet. There's no adrenaline rush in there, but that's what we do. And we're going to getting ready for another one. But right after I got back from that climb in Africa this past summer, we took off on another trip. So when she died, and this is just, Alcoholics Anonymous is so much bigger than me and us, and it affects people in all areas of my life. And people here have touched on my family incredibly when she died. They were all there in a very visible and felt presence with the family around the funeral and everything. So my family has definitely received the rewards of Alcoholics Anonymous from people here, too. And when she died, my youngest niece, her youngest daughter, they have 4 kids, was, of course, in horrible condition. And she finally said one day, well, I don't believe it anyway that doctor Debbie climbs with became a cancer doctor, because her mom died of cancer when she was my age. So she marched up to me one day and she said, you take me there to talk to that doctor, this little 12-year-old at the time. I said, okay, you know, whatever. So we drove up, took her one day. Her dad let her skip school. We drove up to Johns Hopkins. They did a big tour of the lab and everything. And now Bridget's decided she wants to become a cancer research doctor. She's just got into a school for science and technology, and she's on this little path now, and she's in touch with his doctor. And, you know, none of this would have happened. I wasn't even going to go do this climb. And my sponsor said, could the writing on the wall be any clearer that this might, because I've been asking her, how do I make amends for some of this? How do I make amends for some of this stuff when this opportunity came up? So, again, my decision would have, out of fear, kept me out of any of this, you know. And now this little girl has some kind of hope that maybe she can do something to help. So she decides, well, I want to climb a mountain for my mom, too, you know. Oh, we have a whole new mess on our hands. So she couldn't, of course, come to Africa with us, but we tried. But it was not the right thing. Thank God she didn't come. It would have been terrible. But her and my brother, her dad, and their other 3 siblings all decided, we all want to do something to help here. And so we put together the first U.S.-based climb for this climbing team. And a month after Africa, we're getting ready to leave for this 13,000-foot climb with a team of 13 people, including someone I sponsored in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a couple dear friends in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my brother and his four kids. So talk about something meaningful, all coming together, different areas of my life I had never seen come together in this way, and I can't tell you what a gift this has been in the last 2 years to witness this. And it's not about me. It's like watching something so much bigger than me all kind of take shape around me without any meddling on my part, you know, except that 2 days before we were supposed to leave for this trip, we get a call that the guide service is canceling on us, and you can't go. And I called Sharon. I called my sponsor. I'm like, well, I can't tell the 12-year-old. She can't climb this mess. She's been training, I mean, literally carrying all this weight on her back, training to climb this mountain, and all these people had, and we had plane tickets, and we're leaving in 2 days, and I didn't sleep that night. We stayed up the whole night figuring out how we were going to do this without guides. So the next morning, by the time the rest of this team of climbers woke up, they had no idea that the trip was canceled on it. They thought everything was fine, except we have no guides on this mountain. But anyway, it was all, it worked out. And out to stand on a mountain with my brother and his kids and three sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous who all knew what this was about, all coming from things that had started so many years before. These kind of pictures of what's dropped in front of me if I'm in the middle of things here are so much bigger than what I could piece together, what I could imagine. If I told you this is what I want to happen in my life, I would be shortchanging myself beyond belief. And I'm a part of their lives again. I was not a part of their lives. That oldest daughter, whose mom died, had said to me, in fact, I don't really know what happened, but all I know is when you were drinking, I was afraid of you, and I didn't want anything to do with you. And then to be with her on the side of this mountain, I mean, just the contrast from then to this is a picture that I couldn't have painted for myself. So it is something that I don't know how to repay other than saying yes to come talk at a meeting or answering the phone when someone calls wanting help or showing up when someone needs a ride to a meeting. Those are the ways to repay what has been given here and to just keep passing it on a little bit. And I have no idea some days what the picture is going to look like right now. Things are up in the air in all areas of life, and who knows where it's going. But the difference is I used to wake up and feel like, oh, my God, what's going to happen? I have no idea. And now I wake up and it's more like, oh, let's see what happens. You know, there's some good things that happen when I stay out of the way. So I'm very glad to be here tonight and to see all of you. So thank you for having us here.